Hello, everyone. Good afternoon. This is Rajiv S. Khanna for immigration.com, the law office of Rajiv S. Khanna, PC. Today is our community conference call, October 25th, Thursday. The year is 2012. We are going to discuss the questions posted by the community on the forums at forums.immigration.com, as well as any walk-ins or any people who have called in without posting questions. But the way we'll proceed is I'll first answer the questions that have already been posted, then take follow-up questions on the posted questions, and then invite any new issues that have come up from people who have not been able to post. Remember, this call is being recorded, so you have the right not to have your voice recorded. You can just not speak. The call will be made publicly available so people will be able to hear what you say. You may want to conceal your identity. You can make up a name. It doesn't really matter. Sam, Tom, Ram, Krishna, it doesn't matter. Change your name to whatever you want, or Jane. Note that this call does not create an attorney-client relationship. That means I'm answering a few questions as best as I can. It doesn't mean that I have agreed to represent you or our firm has agreed to represent you. Nor are you in any way constrained to, you know, my firm, if somebody sends you a bill for this call, you can just throw it away. Because that's not the kind of relationship we are thinking about. We are here to do a community information session, okay? That said, let me get right into the questions that have been posted. The first question actually is a very interesting question. A lot of people ask that. Can an H-4 holder invest in stock? So we have an H-4 holder who has an SSN while they were on F-1. SSN is Social Security number. Can an H-4 invest in stocks? Well, you know, that's a very interesting question. And this should be true for any status in which you are not allowed to work. H-4, F-2, any status in which you are not allowed to work. Is it possible to invest in stocks? And my answer is probably yes. My judgment of this issue is that yes. As long as you're not doing it in a manner so repetitive as to become a full-time job. Let me explain that. Let's say I invest in stock as a long-term investment, and then I forget about it. Maybe 6-8 months later, I change some investments here and there. But I'm not doing day trading. In other words, I'm not sitting at the computer 2, 3, 4, 10 hours a day buying and selling stock. If you did that, I think you'd be violating H-4 or F-2 or whatever non-work status you have. But if you were to passively invest, just put in the money and forget about it, I do not think you would be breaking any laws. That would be my judgment. Okay? Next question is from SK2008. I have an EAD. 485 has been pending for more than 180 days. If I get an interesting, challenging work offer in the same area from another company, can I shift by using AC-21? And the answer is, if your I-140 is approved, and 485 has been pending for 180 days, you can, of course, change. And even if the current company cancels the I-140, it does not create any problems. Now, here is the interesting part. What if the company closes business due to financial problems? There's a conflict of laws here. There are two different laws that point in two different directions. One law says, and that's a regulation, one law says that if a company stops doing business, USCIS can go in and revoke the I-140. But AC-21 law says, which is a statute, which means it's a higher degree of dignity than a regulation. The AC-21 law says if after 180 days of approval of I-140 pendency of 485, you change jobs to a similar position, your green card is secure. Okay? In my view, even if the I-140 is revoked or even USCIS revokes the I-140, it should not be a problem. The only time in AC21 I-140 revocation becomes a problem is where USCIS says this I-140 was not originally approvable. So if an I-140 is not originally approvable, it really should not have been approved. Hence, AC21 is not available. But if the I-140 was originally approvable, and then later on, due to circumstances such as bankruptcy, it becomes revocable, it should not affect your AC21. So it's no problem. I think you'll be fine. Rajesh wants to know H-4 to F-1. He's currently on H-4 visa. He's got into an MBA course. The university says they have some co-op program by which I can get CPT. You know that a lot of universities have gone through these issues, Tri-Valley University, Northern Virginia, Hargwan. These are the three that I have dealt with, so I know. But one of the pet peeves USCIS has, and I see them all in this particular fact situation, one was people were not physically attending classes. Two was they were getting CPTs from first quarter, which they are not supposed to get unless the degrees require that such CPT be given. So all things considered, when I'm looking at your situation, Rajesh, what I think you should do, make sure the university is accredited. And make sure your particular degree is accredited. Sometimes you can have degree accredited but not the university and vice versa. And what you want to do is, if you don't understand how to figure that out, go to my blogs, and I have there a blog entry, it's a video, that explains with links where you should go to figure out whether a particular degree/university is accredited, basically two levels. You will go to the Department of Education website and figure out for that state, organizations are allowed to issue accreditation. Then you'll go to those organizations' site and see if they have actually accredited this university and this course. So if the degree and course is accredited, chances of getting into trouble are smaller. Okay. You may want to specifically discuss with the university how they meet the requirements of physical attendance, if they have ever been questioned by ICE or STVP about their practices. You may want to ask your international students office. And come back and report to us what they say and what your findings are in a couple of weeks, because we do this every other Thursday, so we can talk again. Then he wants to know, I have 6 years work experience. If I apply for change of status from F1 to H1 in April, can there be any issue since I would be working on CPT and stayed 325 miles from school? And the answer is there could be. We are dealing with those issues. In fact, this morning I had an issue like that. And what we did was we were able to demonstrate to USCIS that the fact that somebody had technically fallen out of status should be forgiven. And they did, actually. They gave us the H-1 within USA. What problem can you get into? I don't think you are engaged in any active fraud. Maximum USCIS can say is, before starting work, go outside, get a visa stamp, and come back. So that's probably the worst-case scenario. And, of course, we don't like to go for visa stamping. That has a whole set of problems by itself. So look into the university's credentialing. I think that would be very important. And if that's in place, then you can go ahead and reasonably expect that you should get your F-1 to H-1 transfer within USA. Okay? Mohit JN09 wants to know, H-1B amendment for consular processing to H-1B. Their situation is they are going to be outside USA while an H-1B is going on. So if they come back to USA after the H-1 approval and they come back on H-4, can they do a change of status within USA from H-4 to H-1? The answer is sure. Basically, a change of status on an approved H-1B is pretty much like doing a new H-1. But it can be done. It's no problem. We do it all the time. So you can enter on H-4 and then do a change of status on an already approved H-1. Perfectly legal. Let me think about one thing, actually. A current employer wants me to go to Canada I would want to come back to USA in August, but then my H-1 status would not be valid. I would like for you to file from H-4 to H-1 maybe a few months, couple of months, September, October, something like that. The only thing that would bother me is that if you're entering on H-4, are you not telling USCIS that I don't want to really work, I want to be on H-4? Maybe it's a non-issue, but it's something to toss around, see what your lawyer suggests, think about it. I'm not sure it's even going to be an issue, but I'm paid to look into shadows just to see if something could come and hurt you. I don't think it should, but you never know. Okay? So the ideal thing is to enter an H-4, then wait a few weeks, at least 60 days or maybe a little bit more, to convert back to H-1. Okay? So any question wants to know, if I'm on H-4, can I get converted to G-4 if I'm being offered a contract from an international organization? So folks, organizations like World Bank, International Monetary Fund, their employees who are not U.S. citizens and immigrants, they get a visa called G-4. So our question is, can an H-4 be converted to G-4 within USA? Yes. Just make sure that you discuss it with the organization. There are some additional forms that you need to get, I-566, this and that, a couple of them. So just check and make sure that all your forms are in place, but yeah, it can be done. Okay? I guess it must be Amitabh, 6546 wants to know certain things. I want to make a couple of things clear. I will not help people fill forms because if you look at the bottom of the form, it says, who helped you fill your form, they must sign. In other words, if I start filling forms, then I'm responsible for putting my name at the bottom of the form, and I become responsible for the whole case. So I cannot really help you fill forms, but generically, I can answer certain questions that will help you understand the issues that you're raising. So I will not help you fill the form. One of your questions was, if a certain amount of experience is not normal for the occupation, is it going to trigger an audit? Well, we had a whole bunch of discussion on what is normal. This issue was discussed with the Department of Labor for many months. Today's thinking is, in the IT industry, general rule, okay, there are so many things that can be variables. Most jobs carry something called SVP. It's a code that Department of Labor assigns, specific vocational preparation. Almost all IT industry jobs carry SVP of between 7 and 8, which means bachelor's plus 2 years or master's with no experience is normal. Bachelor's plus 2 or master's plus 0 is normal. Anything more than that, bachelor's plus 5, bachelor's plus 3, anything more than that is abnormal. So the current thinking is, if your requirements are quote-unquote abnormal for the IT industry, you should state so in the paperwork. And does it trigger an audit? I don't think so. We have, I would say 90-95% of our cases are master's degree cases. And if I compare bachelor's degree cases with EB3 and master's degree with EB2, I can't say I see substantial difference in the two. So in my view, it shouldn't matter. And I also want to mention, again, I don't want to help you fill forms. I don't know what your lawyers are doing about the forms. Question generically, the CALOG language, which any suitable combination of education, training, or experience is acceptable, could it make the job ineligible for EB2? And the answer is, I don't think so. I've struggled with this myself. And Amitabh, I'm very impressed with your knowledge and your degree of research. These are very, very good questions. These are questions that many of the lawyers would not ask. So I'm quite impressed. You must have put a lot of time into this. Your lawyer should be doing this. You see, I have a problem when my clients have to go and do so much work. First of all, they should ask me, and I'll be happy to provide them all the research. So instead of spending 30 hours, they'll spend 30 minutes going over the research I gave them. Because we can share whatever we have with our clients. So your lawyer should do the same thing. If you're interested in knowing more, you should ask for more information from them. So in any case, I have struggled with the Kellogg language as becoming problematic, and I don't think it would. I'll tell you why. Kellogg language is actually implicit, or it is automatically included in a labor certification. When you file a labor certification, Department of Labor regulations say you are required by DOL law to consider anybody who could be potentially qualified for the job. So, in other words, even if you don't put Kellogg language is there by operation of law. If USCIS were to start creating problems with Kellogg language, we would have a situation where one agency is nullifying the regulations of another agency, or in the alternative, they are nullifying the law, which allows us to do an EB2. If Kellogg language were, think about the logic of this situation. It's a very interesting logic. Let us say Kellogg language is objectionable for EB2. If you have Kellogg language, there can be no EB2. Let's take that example. That cannot be. Why? Because Kellogg language is implicit in every labor certification. It is implied. So that means every labor certification cannot be EB2. That means EB2 doesn't exist. You see my logic? So if we were to remove Kellogg language, let me rephrase that. If we were to remove EB2 as a classification altogether because of Kellogg language, we are destroying an entire set created by Congress. We are destroying a law. Can't do that. So I don't think so, and I would... If USCIS ever tries to attack it, I'll be happy to defend it in court because I think we can win on this issue. There's no question in my mind this will be a ridiculous interpretation of the law. They've tried doing it one or two times, but when I pointed this out to them, they backed off. So I think they realize that they have a weak case on this. It'll be very silly for them to insist that Kellogg language destroys EB2. And I'm not aware of any instance other than one or two times they tried this initially a few years ago. We always include Kellogg language in our labor search. I think that's the smart thing to do, even though there's no place for the Kellogg language. Okay? Third thing is, again, generically, if my job says require master's degree with 2 years experience, what if 1 year is before master's and 1 year is after master's? No problem. That's fine. Many years ago, when there were 9 or 10 regions in the Department of Labor, we used to have issues like this come up. New York would say, if you are accepting experience before master's degree, you must say that. No other region in the country required that. But now everything has been unified, and the law is quite clear that for bachelor's degree, EB2, you have to have post-bachelor's experience, 5 years. But for master's degree, it can be before or after master's. We don't care. Amber wants to know, I'm from Pakistan, when will my priority will become current? Amber, I don't know. I wish I could tell you that. It isn't looking good, and I hope that after November, the next administration, whether it is President Obama or Mitt Romney, whoever it is, does something positive for immigration, legal immigration. I think in the presidential debates, I noticed that both sides had expressed some sensitivity towards legal immigration. Previously, legal, illegal, all used to be lumped together, and many groups, including our own, we have worked hard in making that distinction clear to the government and to the legislators that, you know, legal and illegal immigration has separate issues. You cannot combine the two and try to solve them together. So I don't know the answer to that question, Amber. I wish I could tell you. Next question, Krish Forum, Houston. Parents green card in process. I-94 date is fast approaching. Well, you know, Krishna, once you have filed I-485 for your parents, you are a U.S. citizen, they are no longer required to extend their tourist visa. They can continue to stay here as long as the 485 is pending. Okay. Can they stay beyond their 6 months and beyond I-94? No, you already filed the 485. Okay. Should we file an extension? No. Should they go back to India? What is the need? What happens if the green card is rejected? Well, you know, here's an interesting thing. Remember this. It's an important point for U.S. citizens to remember. There is something called 310 bar. If somebody is unlawfully present, their I-94 has expired, 485 has been thrown out, for 180 days, they can be barred for 3 years. If they stay here for 1 year, they can be barred for 10 years. So in other words, if tomorrow your parents' green card gets rejected, 485 gets rejected, they would have approximately 180 days to leave USA without incurring any negative consequences. But a special provision for immediate relatives of U.S. citizens like parents and spouse is this. If your parents did not go out and they continued to stay unlawfully for 1 year or 10 years or 30 years, and then you applied for their green card, they can still get their green card within USA. There will be no 310 bar. 310 bar attaches when you leave the country. And they are not required to leave the country because parents of U.S. citizens can get green card within USA, even if they have overstayed. So really, there is no problem. You don't need to worry about this. If there's any issue, feel free to come back, join us here. Drop me an email, whatever needs to be done. I don't see any problem here. I'll be happy to, you can play this call for mom and dad if they are getting concerned. It doesn't matter. If once their 485 has been filed, they're fine. Okay? Next question is my style. This is an interesting situation. You have a following to join pending, which basically means husband had a 485 based upon employment filed. Later on, wife was also filed. Husband got approved first, wife got stuck in the priority date problem. So she's still waiting, and he gets approved. Not only does he get his green card approval, he even gets his naturalization. First of all, there is a law, which is again one of those things that a lot of people don't know, and it becomes a problem for them. There's a law that says once you have naturalized, your wife cannot take advantage of her 485 following to join. So really, you need to file her I-130. Okay? You need to file her I-130. That's what you need to do. But if she doesn't leave USA, she should not have any problem. She should be able to get her I-130, 485 done here. The more tricky issue is, should you also be filing a second I-485 for her? There's one already pending. And the answer is probably not. You can confirm that with USCIS, but I think filing an I-130 and making reference to that I-485 should attach the I-130 to the pending 485. Double check on this. I'm pretty sure it can be done. And that's how I would handle it. So your question is, can we request USCIS to consider the spouse's pending I-485 for a different category? Yes, file I-130. Do I need to start new I-130, of course, you will have to. But 485, I think you should be able to reuse. As long as it is still pending and USCIS has not denied it by the time you file your I-130. Okay, so file I-130 very quickly. H-1B visa, this is from PBGodai_sis, says, I have traveled on L-1B showing experience with companies like ABC. So the question is, now I wanted to use only the experience of company BCD. Is that a problem? It's not a problem at all. Just make sure that everything is truthful. When you file your 9089, if you have any doubts that something is not truthful, please discuss it with your lawyers. But the fact that you want to omit, first of all, you don't need to omit any jobs. You only need to document the experience that you need. So let's say I have 50 years of experience, and my labor cert requires only 7 years experience. I don't need to document 50 years. I have to list all 50, or I should list all 50, but I will only document 7. That's all I need to document. Okay? So I think this is something you can discuss with your lawyers, but I don't see that as a big problem. Sheikh 1969 has two questions. I had a 245I case filed. So I'm covered by 245I provisions. Now, if I filed, the old employer went out of business, so I couldn't get another green card. Now I have a new employer. The company is 5 years in business, but the owner has only a green card, not a citizen. Can I apply my green card to this company? Sure. There's no requirement that the owner of the company must be a U.S. citizen. Green card holders who own companies can very easily file for other people's green cards. There's no problem at all. Okay. So, two things. If you are, and look into this, 245 grandfathering, which means my earlier case was filed on a timely basis, and then I want to file a second case and take advantage of the old case, 245I, you can do that. That's called grandfathering. You can look into that. And the fact that the owner of the company is a green card holder instead of a U.S. citizen, no issue. Okay? Lavaris, good name, has a question about I-751. His wife and he are going to apply for removal of condition, or in fact, his wife will be applying. They live with their parents, with his parents. They don't have any rental agreements, lease agreements, or mortgages. They have some evidence. And it seems that I-751 needs proof of 2 years of steady commingling of finances. I don't think that's a big deal. Okay? Of course, USCIS does get very jittery when they see out-of-the-ordinary situations. But each situation has to be evaluated based upon its own merits. No two marriages are alike. No two people are alike. So what I would recommend, and if you can afford it, get yourself a lawyer. Get yourself a lawyer locally where you are. I think it will help you. A couple of $1,000 or $3,000, $4,000, whatever they charge, it may be worth spending that money. And if you feel that you don't want to, or if you don't have that money right now to spend, all I can tell you is that each case is different. If you are actually physically living together, whether you are living in your own house or your parents' house, it should be fine. Because even if they do what is called a Stokes interview, which they probably will, where they take husband and wife separately and ask them questions, like which is the last movie you saw together, and match their answers, I think you will pass the Stokes interview. So what is being adjudicated in the removal of condition? Only one thing. Is the marriage genuine? If the marriage is genuine, it doesn't matter if there's commingling of assets. It doesn't matter. We have many cases where I had a case a few years ago. I remember that distinctly because those two people were very, very fine human beings, and I really enjoyed talking with them also. One was a professor in Colorado. The other one was a professor in California. Okay? So they're not living together. They maybe meet over vacations and spend time together. They had not lived together for a while, and we were still able to get the paperwork through without any problems. Okay? Normally, I want you to get a local lawyer because they can go for an interview. Look, guys, for employment-based cases, it usually doesn't matter where the lawyer is. We represent people all over the country, all over the world. Because everything is done by mail. There may be an interview that's hardly there, but you know, it hardly ever happens. Most of the cases go without an interview. And most of you are smart people. You don't necessarily need lawyers to go with you for minor interviews. But in some cases where local lawyer may be a good idea, I would let you know. And I think in I-751 cases, it may be a good idea to get a local lawyer if you can afford it. Ehsan 7, came to U.S. as a student, last entry was on a travel document. Okay, so that means you were probably advanced parole. AOS is still pending. I filed through marriage. Marriage is not going well. Can I file through employment? Yes, you can. And just like I told the other person, they had an employment-based case pending for their wife and they wanted to file I-130. Yours is the opposite of that. You have an I-130 485 pending, and you want to file through employment. You can do that. I don't see any problem. How long does the PERM process take under EB2? EB2, EB3 doesn't matter. PERM process is about the same time. It depends on whether or not you get audited. If you don't get audited, maybe a few months. If you get audited, maybe a few months more. So maybe a year, year and a half for audited cases, maybe 6-8 months for non-audited cases, but nobody can give you guarantees on this. Do I have to stay in legal status all the way through? Yes, you do. Go to H1 if you can. Do I have to pay any penalty if I've appealed legally? I think you may want to think about, Essen, I think what you need to do is, in my view, talk with the lawyer again locally where you are in this case. Because what the law requires is that marriage, when entered into, was entered into good faith. If it was, then later on if it came apart, it is not a problem. You still get your green card through your wife's case. So the reason I want you to talk with a local lawyer is because they might need to go with you to the interview and all. Okay? But you can also start simultaneously a green card through employment. There's no harm in that. Ravi wants to know, 2 H-1B applications filed by the same employer. See, I have a problem with this. They first filed an application as an in-house project. Then in June, they applied another H-1B showing that you were going to work for a client. You see, USCIS is very suspicious of these cases. They say that people just make up an in-house job when they don't have a specific project. An H-1 job should only be filed if you have a specific project. So if you file for an in-house job, often they ask you things like, what is the project? How many other people are working on this project? How many man hours will it take to complete? How many man hours have already been put in? They want all kinds of details about the job, about the project. It's not simply saying. So I'm not surprised. USCIS is questioning it, and they may want to haul up the employer for misrepresentation if they want, or just deny the cases. So they said the reason the employer gave is it was a mistake. Now, how do you file an H-1 by mistake? That doesn't make any sense to me. Okay? I don't know. I doubt very much, Ravi, that this reason would be acceptable. Can I file a new H-1B now or reapply for F-1? No, that's a tough choice. Either way. Okay? Your status needs to be examined. What are you doing so far? What you've been doing, that needs to be examined. I really don't know. There's a lot more I don't know. I hope you're on the phone. If you are, we can talk a little bit more. Okay? H-1B for startup. So the question is, AKAK started his company while he was on OPT, which is okay. You're allowed to do that. Co-founder with a U.S. citizen who is the CEO. I have equal equity. So you're a member of the, you have, we are 50-50 partner or 50% stockholder. That's fine. So can I apply for H-1B transfer to that startup? You can certainly try. It may be worth it. Okay. Can it be a part-time H-1B? You know, H-1B can be on a sliding scale. For example, 30 to 40 hours or 20 to 40 hours. That way, the company has to pay you for the lower number each week by law. If you say 20 to 40, they must pay you for the 20 hours, but they can pay you all the way to 40. Sliding scale is better when in the beginning you think you're going to be working less number of hours, but as time progresses, you might need to put in more work. So sliding scale is better in those cases. It is also possible to have a concurrent H-1. So if you are working with somebody right now, you can have a concurrent H-1 sliding scale 20 to 40 hours with the other company. When you have an H-1 for too few hours, and that's the only H-1 you have, USCIS can ask you things like, how are you going to survive? For example, 10 to 40 hours. How will you survive on 10 hours work? What is your budget? How much money do you need? They can ask you questions like that. Can I continue to be a co-founder of this company? Yes, you will not be able to do a green card, a perm-based green card through this company. That's very unlikely, but you can continue to be a stockholder in the company. As long as somebody can fire you, that's considered to be good enough for an H-1 purpose. Okay? Next question, Super Kings. I know a lot of cases that have been denied because the H-1 was not amended where the employee moved. So 45s are being denied. Previously, it used to be that LCA needs to be updated to a new location. when the new location is within 35 miles, nothing needs to be changed. Well, I've heard noises from the government that they want amendments to be filed even when the relocation is within a few miles. I don't think that is an appropriate reading of the law, and somewhere along the line, somebody will sue them. I think that the correct interpretation of the law is, as long as the movement of the employee, H-1 holding employee, is within normal commuting distance, which is 30, 40 miles, it should not require an H-1B amendment, only an LCA filing. When it is more than normal commuting distance, then an LCA as well as H-1B amendment must be done. What are my thoughts on this? There are no memos on this. There's no discussion so far. I also heard they are applying this retroactively. That is true. I have a couple of cases where they've done that, and we have responded quite strongly. But because the priority dates slipped back, those cases are still pending, so I really don't know what they are going to do. I personally am inclined to file a lawsuit if the government wants to take the position that they can ask for amendments even when the movement is local. As long as the job remains essentially the same, USCIS should not insist on any amendments for local movement. But if the movement is more than local, if it is from state to state, 200 miles, 300, 400 miles, I think they are okay, well within their rights to insist. Okay. I also heard that they are applying this retroactively. If someone has amended the petition 1 year back, the interpretation of the rule never changed 4 or 5 months ago. They have been telling us this, that amendments are needed for movement for many, many years now. I would say about 7, 8, maybe even 10 years. Excuse me. Okay. So this is not new. This is very old. What is new is that they are making noises about movement within 35, 40 miles also, that even then they want to see amendments. Can USCIS be sued? Yeah, yeah, they can be sued for something like that. I think that's a wrong interpretation. And if they want to change their mind about a well-settled practice, it may not be that easy. Will we win? I do not know, but I think it's definitely something that a court should look at. I recently moved to another client in the same metro area, 10 miles. Am I out of status? No H-1B amendment. LCA updated. See, I told you, in my view, only LCA should be updated if the job remains essentially the same. If I required my company, if my company is willing to amend, I don't know the answer to that question. You know what you could do? You could get your company to contact their congressman and get the congressman to get the answer from USCIS, because you and I cannot get a reliable answer unless we actually sue them. Or contact the ombudsman's office. That might be a good idea too, and you can do that yourself. In fact, keep me informed. Contact the ombudsman's office and see what they say. I'll actually have my office do that too, because I'm interested in knowing what the USCIS is thinking on this is. Okay? So if you guys, you may want to remind me, Ravi. I'm sorry, is this Ravi? Super Kings. Just send me an email to help@immigration.com. help@immigration.com, reminding me that I was going to ask the ombudsman about what USCIS interpretation of this amendment rule is. Okay? So let's just figure out more about this, and then we'll see what happens. Satya.horizon. Satya says, my labor was filed in the EB3 as assistant facility engineer. Okay. Can I apply for labor under EB2 with a different company as a systems analyst? Because a lot of my experience is in the medical field, not in the IT field. I cannot predict that. It depends upon the kind of labor search you're filing. If the experience is related to what you do, even if it's medical experience, no problem. But if it is not related, then of course you can't use that. You need 5 years of progressively responsible post-bachelor's experience. And, of course, common sense says the experience should be related to what you do. Can I transfer my priority date if the old employer cancels my I-140? Yes. Yes. Current thinking of USCIS is, unless the I-140 is revoked for fraud, You will carry your priority date with you, even if the old employer cancels the I-140, before porting the date to a new I-140, even then. Okay? All right. Folks, now what I want to do is I'm finished with the questions that were posted. So what I want you to do is people who have posted questions and have follow-up questions on those posted questions only, please press 5-star on your phone. 5-star. Press 5-star. Okay? Let us see. I think my other machine is frozen for some reason. Logging into it again. Bear with me a moment. I'm logging into the conference call again. Somehow I got kicked out. But you press 5-star on your phone if you have a follow-up question. I have 1, 2, 3 follow-up questions only. So once I'm done with these, then we'll start of 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Once I'm done with these, and don't worry, I'll take all the time it needs. I'll answer everybody's questions before I hang up. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 follow-up questions. Okay, no problem. I will proceed in the order in which people logged into the conference. So, area code 312, can you hear me? Area code 312?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, go ahead with your question, please.
Hi, this is Rajesh. Actually, I asked a question related to that H4 F1 visa. You know, I stay around 325 miles from the school, and what school says is they just have two classes, which happens on a Saturday once a month, and that's like one class in the morning and one class in the evening.
I have seen your facts. I know that you don't have to repeat that.
Okay, so my question was, does this suffice for maintaining a full-time student?
Well, that's what I asked you. I said, do your homework. Begin first by finding out if the school and the degree are accredited. If they are accredited, discuss these issues that you have with the International Students Office.
Okay.
And then
okay.
Talk to me again in 2 weeks after you've done this homework.
Sure, that's fine. Thank you.
That's what I want you to do. Okay.
Thank you, Fina. Thank you.
Good luck, Rajesh.
Thank you.
Okay. Next question is area code 347. Hello?
Hello?
Yes, I can hear you. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, I was the one who asked you the question regarding the two H-1B petitions.
Right.
So what are my alternatives now? Suppose if it gets rejected and they void the even approved H-1, I just have 1 month, 10 days of OPT left. What would be my alternatives to switch over to a new employer, or should I switch to F-1 to maintain the status?
Well, I don't know if F-1 is such a good idea. But you have two H-1Bs, and they are both likely to be revoked. So, Ravi, I don't know if I have a good suggestion for you, but if USCIS finds the H-1 objectionable, let's do the bottom-up analysis.
Yeah.
Bottom line, if they revoke your H-1, you will be subject to the quota, and then you have the April-October cycle again. That means you can only apply for an H-1 April 1st and start working October 1st. If I were you, I would prepare for that.
But can you come again? I did not get you.
You should be prepared for April-October cycle, because if they revoke your H-1, you are subject to the quota.
Okay.
So first thing I would do is I would prepare for the April-October cycle. Now, the question is, how do I stay in USA if I want to stay in USA till April 1st? Is F1 a good option? Your guess is as good as mine. I think the best option, of course, is to be outside USA and wait for the April-October timeline. But if you genuinely wish to study and further your qualifications, you can go for an F1, but don't go for a university that's not recognized, not accredited. Go for a good school.
Okay.
Okay? That's what I would
okay. say. Thank you.
You're welcome. Good luck.
Yeah.
Okay. Next question is area code 973. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Rajiv. This is about the question about the AC21, issues of AC21. Here is my situation. Like my 140 is approved and 485 has been pending more than 180 days. And like what I understood from you is I can apply AC21 if you want to change the company. If the current employer, even if he cancels 140 or if the company is not going well and he is out of the business, and the USAs will automatically cancel 140, right?
Even if the I-140 is canceled, AC21 should protect you. So I don't think it's going to be a problem as long as the job is same or similar.
Okay, yeah, the job is same. And what will happen if the new company transfers my H1? Will that impact any 485?
It should not.
It should not. Do I need to, again, reapply label 140, anything else from the new company?
Jobs are same or similar. AC21 says you don't have to apply for green card all over again. You simply port the green card over.
Okay, even if the new company transfers H1.
Right. What number question were you? I'm kind of struggling trying to find this. What number question do you remember?
Question number is 3.
3, okay. Yeah, I keep going up and down. I can't find. Oh, yeah, because it's a very short question. Okay, yeah. So even if the I-140 is revoked or canceled, the only time you have a problem is if it was not originally approvable. If it was originally approvable, you are fine.
Yeah, it was approved.
No, approved and approval are two different things.
What does that mean?
Well, I gave an example. For example, let's say, when they filed the I-140, USCIS didn't realize that your degrees were not okay.
Mm-hmm.
And later on they realized, then they will revoke the I-140, then you would lose your priority date as well as AC21.
Okay.
Or another example is, if USCIS made a mistake, didn't realize that their tax returns were not okay. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
They can go back and revoke, because then they can take the position that the I-140 was not approvable when filed. Very, very tricky situation. Most AC21s don't run into problems, but that's something to keep in the back of your mind.
Okay. See, what happened is when we filed 140, actually USCIS gave the NOID to me, and my lawyer reapplied that. He sent a note, and
that
it was approved.
That actually makes me a little more comfortable. That means they have already challenged and then backed off. So they, you know, I think you should be fine. It actually makes me feel a little bit more secure.
Okay. And even if there is a variation in the salary, does it matter? Like a 30% more than what I'm getting now?
You need to listen to my AC21 videos as well as read my blog. I have a lot of information on AC21.
Okay.
I would say deepen your knowledge and then come back if something is not clear.
Okay. Thanks, Ajay. Thank you very much.
Minor differences, ordinary differences in the salary should not create a problem for you.
Okay.
Okay?
All right. Thank you, sir.
All right. Bye-bye. Okay, we have 3 more follow-up questions. Area code 650. Go ahead, please.
Hi. I'd asked a question regarding the G4 visa.
Yes, ma'am.
I just wanted to find out, is there a minimum term that the contract must be to get the G4?
In matters of G4, it is the internal staff of the organization that can guide you best. And as far as I know, there is no minimum term.
There's no minimum term?
No, ma'am.
And the application will be made by the organization, or can I also get a letter from them and then make the application on my own?
They will get you a couple of of forms that they need to get for you. I think it's one is I-566, the other one is I-530. I don't remember the names of the forms. But
uh-huh.
you get a couple of forms through
okay.
the but then you do the filing yourself.
I will be filing on my own.
Yeah, but you know, again,
okay.
it depends upon the organization. If they want to assist you, they can. But the ultimate application for change of status is your own application. Whether or
okay.
not they assist you is up to them.
Okay, got it, got it. And the G4 processing time is typically very short. I believe it's a fairly simple visa to obtain.
Bite your tongue. When you're dealing with G4, nothing is simple. Okay? But you have
right,
an
option. Right.
You can just take a trip to Canada and get a G4 stamping and come back. It's a one-day process.
Right, right. Okay. Okay, thank you so much. Thanks.
Welcome. Good luck.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Okay, area code
201,
go ahead please.
Rajiv, mine was question number 10. I'm naturalized and my wife's 45.
Mom and dad, Krishna, right?
Excuse me?
Oh no, this is the following to join. I got it.
Yeah, mine was question number 10.
I have it.
Yeah, I'm naturalized, my wife's 45 is pending. So my question is, can I like file this myself, or do I need to hire a lawyer? Like, what is the best?
If you can afford a lawyer, and,
mm-hmm.
and it's not a problem hiring a lawyer, get yourself a lawyer. It just is a little tricky. It's not really rocket science, but I would
okay.
feel a whole lot more comfortable if you had a lawyer.
Okay, and then we need that 864 also with the 130.
130, you always need 864, definitely.
Okay. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Okay, now we have the last of the posted questions, then we'll take new questions. This is from area code 801. Go ahead, please.
Hey, Raju. This is Kumar. I have not asked, posted the question, actually. I have a question to ask you directly.
Okay, so I'm going to ask you to hold then, Kumar, please.
Okay.
Let me just invite everybody's questions, and then I'll take you in turn, okay? Sit tight.
Okay, all right.
Folks, anybody has any question, press 5-star, and I will take you in the order in which you logged into the conference. So the people who came in earlier, I will take first. People who came in later, I'll take later. I have 5 questions so far, 5 sets of people. So let's start with the one who logged in the earliest. Area code 905. Go ahead, please.
Hi, I actually have 2 questions for you. My first question was for sponsoring family for green card. I wanted to understand for birth certificate translation from Hindi to English. It was done back in 2001. Does it have to be translated again with a more recent timestamp, or like how does that work?
There is no requirement in the law that the translations be current, but doing translations is really easy. The
okay.
immigration law only requires that whoever translates, I prefer that it not be a family member. It can be any friend. What they'll do is they'll translate the birth certificate, and at the end of the certificate, or even on a separate sheet, they'll put the following language: translator's certification. I, comma, Ram Prakash Nirula, comma, whatever their name is, hereby certify that I am conversant with both Hindi and English languages, and that I have translated the above or the attached, depending upon whether you're using a separate sheet or the same sheet, document from Hindi to English accurately and to the best of my knowledge and ability. Period. Signed, below that, full name, full address, phone number. Very simple.
Okay, so anybody can do it, just not family members, I guess.
I don't recommend family members. Anybody can do it.
But what if they choose to use the notarized and the attested copy from 2001? Would that suffice?
Well,
if
USCIS doesn't like something, you can always supplement it. It's not the end of the world.
Okay, so they would, I guess, write back to us and let us know that they need a more
document. Yes, they will not throw your case out for a faulty translation. They'll send you a
okay.
RFE.
Okay. And my second question is, if a green card is pending and if somebody decides gets to work in the meantime, like they won't go on a TN visa, can that be done concurrently or do you have to first cancel your I-130 that's pending before you can apply for a TN visa?
Getting a TN, once an I-130 has been filed, even if it is later withdrawn, is dicey.
Mm-hmm.
It is very difficult to say whether you're going to be able to get your TN or not. H-1, yes, no problem. L-1, no problem. L-2, no problem. H-4, no problem. But TN may not be a dual intent visa. So when somebody has a pending I-130 or once had an I-130 pending, government can decline to issue entry on TN.
I see. Okay.
Right?
Okay. All right. Thank you.
If you are going to work in the meantime, do an H-1. That's the better option.
H-1 is a better option. Okay.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Bye. Okay. So, 1, 2, 3, 4 more questions, guys. Area code 617. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Rajiv. This is Param. Thanks for doing the service. And I posted a question 2 weeks back about my attorney filing my 140 under the wrong category, under EB3 instead of EB2. And at that time, you suggested, why don't you check with the senator's office if they can contact USCIS. I sent out my paperwork, and I'm in touch with them. Looks like my initially, when I spoke to the customer service representatives, they said there could be two 140s, but finally I got to know that there is only one, and that is under EB3. So I'm seeing if I can file an EB2 petition with any employer. Do I have to be on their payroll? And if it is possible for self-petitioning my own EB2 or EB1?
Your first question is, generically speaking, I don't know all the facts of your case, but I'm going to go generically. Your first question is, can a person file an EB2 case by themselves without an employer, correct?
Yes.
No. The only exception is a national interest waiver. So most people don't qualify for NIW. So the first answer is, can I file it by myself? Probably not. Okay. Your second question was, can a future employer for whom I'm not working file an EB2 case for me? Sure. As long as they have the intention sometime in the future, either after or before approval of the green card, to hire you, and you have the intention to go work for them, yeah, sure, no problem.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, now, I want to understand something, Pam, and I'm kind of a little fuzzy on the facts. You said your attorney filed your I-140 by checkmarking the wrong box. They checkmarked EB3 instead of EB2?
Yes.
That's very easy to correct. Okay.
Well,
now,
I've put in a request for USCIS. My attorney is not responding, so I sent an email and whatnot.
Wait. Yes. Wait, let's get the facts straight. I don't think you've done a consultation with me, have you?
I wrote a question a couple of weeks back,
You just did an informal exchange. Okay. No. You see, here's what I would like. This may be money well spent. I would like to take a look at your I-140.
Okay.
And I don't mind doing it free for you. If you just post on the next call, post for me either a copy of the I-140, you can delete all identifying information, or you can even email me a copy of the I-140 and we can talk during the next conference call.
Thank you so much.
Let me take a look at it, because there may be a way to save this quite easily.
Okay.
Okay. Before I make that decision, I want to look at your I-140.
All right. Thank you so much, Rajiv.
Not to worry. Good luck.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. Three more questions, guys. We are getting to the end. Area code 773. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Rajiv. This is Muzamil. I have a question regarding my wife, EAD. Actually, my priority date is 2004 EB3, And in 2007, my EB3 was current, and I applied for EBT and EB. I applied for EAD and advanced parole.
Okay.
And in 2011, one of the attorney has suggested me to apply for my wife EAD also, even though the priority date is not current.
They cannot do that because at that point, if the priority date is not current, you cannot file 485 for her. If you cannot file 485 for her, you cannot get an EAD.
But it means based on the attorney means information, we filed it and we got approved.
Okay, let me understand this. You got an EAD for your wife even though she had no 485 pending, correct?
Right.
Okay, well, that EAD should not be used. Anyhow, keep going.
So the EAD got approved and advance parole got approved. So she, and after 1 year, we again after that EAD has expired, we again reapply for the renewal for my wife.
Okay.
So, means what they did is, deny the, 485 application on June 28,
2012. Whose 485?
For her.
Yours or hers?
For her.
Oh, I see. So what you did was, the first time around, you filed her 485 and her EAD at the same time, correct?
No, at that time she was in India when I was getting the EAD and advance parole.
Wait. Stop right there. I'm very confused. Listen to me very carefully. July 2007, you applied your 485 all set.
Right.
Then she enters USA on H-4.
Right.
But by that time, the priority dates have slipped back.
Right. So at the time,
when the priority date is not current, you filed her 485 and EAD.
Right.
Right. See, previously when I asked you, you said I filed EAD only. Now, here's the interesting thing. If you filed 485 and EAD and they issued the EAD, I don't think it's illegal if you use the EAD.
Okay.
If you had filed an EAD without a 485, I would have said that's very illegal.
Okay.
Okay. But if they have mistakenly approved the 485, taken in the 485 and approved the EAD, that's their problem.
Okay.
Okay. So I would very strongly argue that EAD was okay. Now, what is your question? Keep going.
So what they did is, recently, a couple of months back, they sent the notice of denial for 485 for my wife.
Yeah, of course they did, because that 485 was never ripe for filing. It should not have been filed.
Right. So I also didn't get the denial letter. And the attorney also didn't get the denial letter for my wife. And when my EAD has been rejected for the renewal, then I called the USCIS, and then they sent it again, that denial letter to us again. And in that denial letter saying that your priority date was not current, that's the reason, we deny the 485.
Of course. And we
cannot approve again. We cannot renew the advance parole and EAD for your wife.
Sure.
So, but right now she doesn't have any H-4 status, and I'm also working on EAD, and my H-1 is also expired because I thought I'm using EAD, so that's the reason my employer also not renew the H-1 also.
Let me stop you here for a second. I understand your situation. You don't have H-1. You are working on EAD. Her 485 has been kicked out. What do we do? Well, she is accruing unlawful presence in USA starting from the date her 485 was kicked out. That means if she continues to stay in USA for 180 days, barred for 3 years, continues to stay for 1 year, barred for 10 years if she were to leave USA. What should you do?
Okay.
You should go back to H-1, get her back in on H-4, make sure she leaves USA before the 180 days. She comes back on H-4 visa. You live happily ever after.
Okay. So that's the only option I have.
Unless she qualifies for her own H-1, that's the only option I see.
Okay. like I already told to my employer about the H-1, refiling the H-1, but again, if I want to file the H-1, then I have to go for the stamping, right?
Yes, you will. You can try getting an H-4 without stamping, but probably you'll have to go for stamping.
Okay. One more question. If my H-1 got approved here, can I send my wife for H-4 stamping based on my H-1 approval?
You can try, but in many, many cases, if not all cases, consulates do insist that you go get either change of status or visa stamping. In your case, it will have to be visa stamping before they will consider your wife's application. So you can try once without getting H-1 yourself. I don't think they're going to give it to you. Let me rephrase that. They're not going to give it to you because you will not have a change of status. So in order for you to convert from 485 pending to H-1, there is no choice but to leave USA, get a stamping, and come back. So I take back what I just said. You are required to get visa stamping before they'll give your wife an H-4.
Okay. So there is no chance for her to directly go and get a stamp without my help.
I doubt that very much.
Okay. Any other option, Rajiv, apart from this?
No, when you were talking, I was already considering what the options are. No, there is no other option that I can see.
So apply the new H-1 and then get a stamp. That's the only option I have.
Yes, sir. That's what it looks like.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much, Rajiv, for your help on this.
You're welcome. Good luck.
Okay. Bye-bye.
All right, guys. Two questions left, last two questions. Area code 801. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Rajiv. This is Kumar, and I have a question regarding the priority date porting. So I want to switch my company from company A, which is a consulting firm, to a permanent role.
Sure.
Okay. So the second company which I'm going is willing to file my EC after 6 months or 1 year. Okay. And the thing is, what all documents do we need for my priority date to be ported? I have an approved 140, which is 6 months
old. A copy
old.
Of your I-140 approval notice. If you also want to do AC-21, it would be nice to have a copy of the 9089.
Okay. What if the employer A is not willing to give me a copy of 140 or copy of labor, anything?
Are you planning to do an AC-21 porting, or are you trying to do a new green card?
It's a new green card, company. I go to company B, and they start my green card from scratch.
What you should do is contact the ombudsman office, also USCIS customer service. Let them know your issue. I don't think it's a problem, even if you don't have a copy of the I-140, because USCIS should be able to dig up your priority date just based upon your name, social security number, if there's an A number, et cetera. So
okay.
Even without an I-140 approval copy, you should be okay to carry your priority date forward.
Okay, so do I need to write a letter in writing, stating all my information and request for priority date rollover?
I would, no. That they should do automatically.
What I want you to do
is give USCIS customer service a call. If you don't get good response from them about your questions, give the ombudsman a call, and let's see how that works out. Okay? So,
who was that? The second one?
Ombudsman. U.S.
Ombudsman.
Ombudsman.
Okay.
Okay? That word is, in Hindi we have Lokpal.
Yeah, okay. Oh, is it the FOIA thing?
That's
Freedom for Information Act?
No. There is an office in USCIS called Ombudsman's Office.
Okay.
Ombudsman is what in Hindi they call Lokpal. It's somebody,
okay.
It's an office that's supposed to make things easier for people who are dealing with USCIS. So
okay.
If you can't get good results from USCIS, you can contact the Ombudsman's Office.
Okay, so I'm still in the process of transition, so I can do that anytime, once my new employer files my GC, right?
I would like you to contact your lawyers who are helping you with the H-1. Make sure they are aware of the situation let them help you with it, but there are ways around it. I wouldn't worry too much about it.
Okay, and one more question on top of that. What if my company rejects my 140? Like, what is it?
Do you have time left on your 6 years of H1?
Oh, yeah, a lot.
Okay, they revoke your I-140, you are still entitled to carry your priority date form.
Oh, okay, even they withdrew my I-140.
Right. Once
if it's not for
priority date belongs to you, only two circumstances in which the priority date can get taken away. One, if it is revoked for fraud, and two, if it was not approvable when filed.
If it was not approved by?
Approvable when filed. I discussed that quite in detail with somebody else today. Listen to the conference.
Okay. Yeah, I'll listen to the conference call. Thanks, Rajiv. So I would be safe if even I don't get the 140 copy.
I think so. But I want you to take this on with your lawyers who are doing the H1 and the green card. I personally don't think it's going to be a problem.
Okay. All right, Rajiv. Thank you.
You're welcome. Good luck. All right, guys, last question, area code 704. Go ahead, please, 704.
Hi, Raju. Thank you so much for taking the call and for the service. I have the EB3 case pending for a while now with the priority date back in February 2004, and we filed new 140 and got approved, and I think the new 140 also shows the old priority date. Do I need to do anything, or the attorney need to send any kind of document for the USCIS?
I understand your situation. You have two green cards in work, right?
Right.
First one was filed back in 2004. The I-140 was approved, correct?
Right.
Then you filed a second one, where the I-140 also got approved, and it shows the 2004 date.
Right, but the second one is EB2, the previous one is EB3.
I understand. That's okay. That's perfectly fine.
Okay.
So, yeah,
okay.
That's all you need.
Okay.
It doesn't matter which category the earlier case was approved in. The priority date can be ported from one category to another category. And because your I-140 approval has the right date, 2004, you have nothing more you need to do.
Okay. So, and also I think I'm hearing some of the cases where they don't have H1 in case of working on EAD. I also don't have H1 and purely on the EAD. Will that cause any issues or that shouldn't?
I don't see any issues. I personally prefer people maintain their H1, but that's a personal preference.
Okay.
Okay.
But this company, they didn't want to file again new H1.
I understand that.
So
H1 can be restrictive. I understand that. I really cannot find fault with it. But I personally prefer that people maintain their H1.
Okay, but not having that should not have any issues with the approval of H1, right?
I don't think so. Having an H1 gives you an additional option if there is a problem with the I-140 or 485 later on. But not having it is not the end of the world. It just takes away those additional options you might have.
Okay. Okay. Sorry?
Yeah, you have any other question?
Yeah, one more question. So, but we don't know how long they can take after the 140 is approved, when the date is current for adjusting the 485.
Once the priority date is current, it should take only a few months. But I don't know how long they will take. Nobody can predict that.
Okay. Sure. Thank you, Rajesh.
Good luck. Thank you, guys, for all of you for being here. I will see you next Thursday, and then we'll talk again. Good luck.